We're going to call House Judiciary to order. We're just taking public testimony today on House Bill Number 96, Crimes Involving Marijuana and Other Drugs by the governor. And we have a doctor online that has a time constraint, so we'll go ahead and take Dr. David Murray's testimony. Are you there, Dr. Murray?
Yes, I am. Thank you.
Thank you for being patient. My apologies.
Of course.
Okay. Go ahead and state your name if you want for the record and then your testimony.
Yes, thank you. I'm Dr. David Murray. I'm with the White House Office of National Drug Control Policy. I have previously weighed in with testimony in the past couple of weeks and was going to be available for questions today further. I just wanted one opportunity to respond to one set of questions that I think might still be in the air regarding marijuana potency and the potential impact on health with the recent research literature we've seen over the last, let's say, 5 years, increasing our sense of the risk to adults as well as particularly to youth from exposure to high-potency cannabis consumption and the predispositions towards mental health impact on top of the regular concerns we've had for some time about the smoking of this substance and the carcinogens, tars, and unhealthy substances exposed there, and the behavioral correlates we've already seen with high cannabis consumption linked to a number of pathologies from school delinquency to criminality to amotivational syndrome and poor performance. In addition to that, the recent literature on risks for depression, mental illness, schizophrenia, and the rest that are showing up, particularly where there's high exposure to marijuana and a predisposing susceptibility to mental health episodes, to striking conjunction of events with additional research showing that marijuana consumption can be an independent risk factor even in those who do not have predisposing or predisposition vulnerabilities for mental health episodes. It is linked in the literature now to triggering even the onset of these episodes. So there's a lot of warning signs out there. It has been argued, I think, on the part of some who have not attended to the most recent data, that there has not been a steep change in the potency of the active ingredient in cannabis, THC, the intoxicating ingredient. But I think that our research records from the National Institute of Drug Abuse, based upon analyses of samples since 1979, show that there's been a fairly steep rise, fairly steadily, up through the 1980s, when potency probably averaged around 3.5 to 4%, after rising from what was considerably lower potency during the period of time that we sort of associate with the counterculture in the 60s and Woodstock. So by the mid-80s, you have a fairly steep rise already in the 3.5 to 4% rate. And then I think the important news is to acknowledge in the last 10 years alone, that's basically since the mid-90s until now, we have seen another doubling of that potency rate, so that by 2004, we see data saying that the average potency of THC that is available as analyzed by seized samples of marijuana on U.S. streets is now exceeding 8% potency, obviously with some ranges up to 25 to 30% have been found in the street scene. That's unusual, but it is there, as well as an increase in the proportion of market share, that is high-potency THC, the percentage of the potency above 8 or 9% is becoming an increasing share of the available market. That is, what is a young person likely to run into if they're purchasing on the street? Increasingly, it is no longer marijuana in the 3 to 5% range. Proportionally, it is increasingly likely to be marijuana above the overall mean average of 8%. It is likely to be very high-potent indeed. It has been argued by some further that this should not be regarded as necessarily translating into greater health risk, because it is possible for, and they use the technical term titration, it is possible for a user to correspondingly cut back on the volume consumed in proportion to the increased exposure to the highly potent intoxicating element of THC, which is, after all, an addictive substance that does produce withdrawal syndromes as well as the problem of dependency. My impression is that that is not a good case, that titration is, in fact, able to explain what we are seeing. It is not a definitive argument. No one knows for sure. In certain populations of experienced users, perhaps it is possible that they are, in fact, curtailing the sheer volume of smoke ingested as a function of how much potency there is. But that is not a consistent, that explanation is not consistent with the general literature we see here. We have seen an increase over the last decade, a tripling, in fact, of the rate of admissions for treatment dependency, need for treatment dependency based upon cannabis. We've seen a tripling in that, from 45 per 100,000 to over 118 per 100,000, with no greater volume of marijuana being consumed. That suggests that there's some dynamic in here that is leading to greater risk of dependency over the last 10 years. And as we said, within the last 10 years, we've seen a doubling of potency.
Dr. Murray, just for my benefit, too.
Yes, ma'am.
Go into details about what THC is and why it is the bigger concern in terms of its percentage of potency in marijuana.
Well, because of recent literature in the last decade and a half has progressively unfolded the consequences and pervasiveness in the brain, in the immune system, in the human system of cannabinoid receptors. Now, I don't want to get, everybody's eyes glaze over here, but I'll try and just give a brief synopsis. THC is a cannabinoid substance. There are multiple substances that are cannabinoids in typical marijuana smoke, as well as other carcinogens, TARs, and other things that are in there that are contaminants. Cannabidiol is one of the substances that we find, and THC, tetrahydrocannabinol, is the intoxicating element. Some years ago, it was discovered, about 1988, that the THC was binding to receptors in the brain. That's interesting. Why would we have in our brain receptors for what is, after all, a wild weed that when smoked produces this substance? Well, that certainly helped to explain why we get the high that we get, because the THC molecules bind to these receptors. But it raised another question. Why would we have these naturally present receptors? There must be, and we use the term endogenous, there must be some endogenous substance inside the body that is already meant for those receptors, that the exogenous sources, the external plant-smoked marijuana-sourced substances, attach to and block. So that's set out a sort of scientific research for what would be those naturally occurring substances that are endogenous. And what's basically come out of that is the recognition of two different types of receptors in the brain and in the immune system, CB1 and CB2, that are naturally responsive to the body's own production of a chemical that are now called anandamides. Anandamides are chemically, molecularly similar enough that they are the proper substance that should be binding to these receptors, that when a cannabinoid molecule comes in from the external source, from marijuana, it goes to those same receptors. Now, what this suggests is that developmentally, we have a fairly delicate and apparently quite important regulatory system that affects our brains and our immune systems, involving pain, involving mood, involving a variety of normal brain and neural system functions. That suggests further then that because cannabinoids, marijuana smoke, can affect that system, we should be doubly cautious because we may very well be interfering with the natural regulation of a fairly sensitive system that we may be triggering or predisposing towards certain levels of attachment. The natural anandamides do not bind for long. They bind fairly quickly and then move on. The cannabinoids, on the other hand, bind to these receptors for a considerable period of time, not only producing the high, but other effects as well. This suggests we need to be more wary about the long-range potential impact in terms of neurophysiology and developmental cycle on what it is that early exposure of cannabinoids might do to the brain's own regulatory system.
Interesting. And so the anandamides, they're mood regulatory. They're meant to sort of enhance or stabilize mood or.
My guess is that, and this is beyond my ken, by the way, at this point, in terms of what we will find out about anandamides. They are apparently involved in a variety of functions within the brain. There are certain receptors that are tuned to cannabidiol, other receptors that are tuned to the THC. Likewise, in the immune system, it has to do with pain, has to do with mood. Certainly, the anandamides produce euphoric, good mood feelings, like when we get an A on a test. They can be triggered. There are other functions as well that are being discovered. They apparently are involved in such things as appetite regulation, on inflammatory responses. And this is why, in many measures, the scientific community is somewhat excited about the prospect that there might be proper scientific and medical regulatory investigations that could produce valuable medications. But they will not be raw, smoked, crude weed that contaminated with carcinogens in unknown quantities and in unknown dosages. That will be the nature of the medicines that could come forward. But there is a lot of exploration going on here with regard to the potential benefits of developing medications that attach to these receptors with proper regulatory controls and dosage and purities. But it also suggests that we're messing with a very powerful system here when we have a youth exposed to these exogenous sources that are not dosage regulated and pure.
Yeah.
May I ask a question?
Yeah. Representative Gruenberg.
You used the words endogenous?
Yes, sir.
Doctor, what is
that? I apologize.
I'm unfortunately only a lawyer.
Yeah, no, I'm sorry. I didn't mean to try to be flip about this. I was trying to be rapid. The endo versus exo are used as attachments to these words in terms of whether they come from within your own organic system. That will be endocannabinoids. Or whether they're exogenous, that is external, they're from an outside source.
Thank you.
So you might have an endogenous system that regulates hormones or moods or pain receptors that are generated within your own system naturally, or you might take an exogenous outside source, a pill, let's say, that triggers those effects in you.
Thank you.
Dr. Murray, I know you have to go. What do we know about... just sort of sitting here, I can think of examples, and others in the room may be able to, too. You know, sort of kids that you grew up with that you knew were smoking dope. And I see them now, and conversations are interesting. This isn't in every case, but there's a slowness and a kind of almost a way that they speak and a tone and a memory thing. Is there any scientific knowledge about what marijuana does in young people in terms of the memory and the speech and that?
Well, this is emerging, and again, it's very difficult to say we have definitive pictures of exactly the adolescent brain. There are neuroimaging results that have shown changes in the brain as a result of addiction and dependency, and cannabis consumption itself produces these changes. We also move backwards in our understanding from observing the behaviors and the cognitive performance. High-level, frequent marijuana users, and I point out again, which I think you already know, the Alaskan rate of past year cannabis consumption is not only the highest in the nation, it's considerably higher than, it's like 16.7%. Tennessee is like 7%, the national average around 10%. You've got a lot of people being exposed. What we know behaviorally and cognitively is that memory is affected, cognitive performance is affected, there is an impact on what is called the motivational syndrome, the willingness, the eagerness, the alacrity with which one engages in tasks and performances. We can see this behaviorally, and as the years are going by, we're discovering more and more what is the biological substrate or the underpinning, what has happened in the brain, what has happened in the personality, what has happened in the emotional system that is underpinning these behavioral changes that we're seeing. We're seeing it in the, here's a suggestion that I think is quite disturbing, that is, once again, being explored. We're getting better information all the time. We know that there are populations in the United States that are highly vulnerable to cannabis use, where there are young women, ages 16, 17, 18, 19, who become pregnant, who do not desist in their cannabis use. Now, we've all had the tragic experience of learning about fetal alcohol syndrome. in utero exposure to the mother's drinking that produces lifetime retardation and problems. We've already learned to warn women not to expose themselves to lead paint or tobacco when pregnant because this has an in utero impact. We are beginning to see likewise in populations of young women who persist in cannabis smoking, and it can rise as high as 20% in some communities of women who are pregnant with a child in utero here who are consuming cannabis. And we're beginning to recognize this is having developmental consequences on the emerging child, that they are going to be born with vulnerabilities, predispositions, risks, and developmental problems. Increasingly, we're starting to see those triggers in there. And it's a warning sign that we've been running an experiment on the next generation here by the early and youth exposure to increasingly high-potency marijuana that is having consequences that we are carefully uncovering year by year that are deeper and more pervasive than we realized.
I know you have to go, but a final question Representative Guerra has.
Hi, Dr. Murray. I appreciate it. We're supposed to be making findings here, and I know you have time constraints, but frankly, without being able to ask you a lot of follow-up questions on all that you just said, I can't make heads or tails of a lot of it. You've made a lot of statements about conditions that are emerging, evidence that's
right.
emerging, things
that's
we're
right.
starting to see, things that we're beginning to see. And this is my question. Of all the conditions you've discussed, I've got two questions. Of all the conditions you've discussed, which ones are there peer-reviewed scientific evidence establishing a link between pot and that condition for? I want to know which ones there's peer-reviewed evidence substantiating the link. And the other question I have is, you've mentioned, and I've never heard this before, so this one's intriguing. The use of pot when somebody's pregnant, and I guess logic would tell me that's not a good thing, but can you compare the effect of pot on somebody who's pregnant to the use of alcohol on somebody who's pregnant and the use of tobacco on somebody who's pregnant? Is it more serious, less serious? What's the science on that?
The second question with regard to comparative analyses, I can tell you that we simply do not know. There is not a basis, I don't think, yet for saying that the relative effect of dropping an anvil on your foot as opposed to a sledgehammer on the other foot is necessarily going to be weighed out. I think that there's no question but what all three of them have consequence, and my impression is that we are learning more about that. But let me try and be as clear as I can about the first statement. Each one of the things I alluded to can be backed up with peer-reviewed formal publications and citations in the peer-reviewed literature. Everything from behavioral issues, cognitive and memory issues, to concerns about mental illness and schizophrenia. When I say emerging literature, I'm saying the definitiveness and the degree and pervasiveness of the problem and the risk is emerging. But what we have rock solid and know very thoroughly is a whole body of evidence that we've had around for a couple of decades that there are risks. This has been well known, the risks of the smoking, the risks organically, the risks to cognition, memory, and performance, the risks to the emotional outcomes, the risks to delinquency, the risks to criminality. These associations have been in the literature for some period of time. What I'm saying is emerging is new literature that's even more focused and consequential than we'd seen in our previous formulation of knowing that cannabis consumption is risky, in particular cannabis consumption on the part of young people as the age of initiation falls is unusually risky for their future in terms of dependency, addiction, withdrawal, and likelihood of dependency on yet other substances, including alcohol later in life, are very strongly associated with age of initiation. Third piece is the emerging literature on the added component of the increased potency accelerating this whole phenomenon. That's emerging. And lastly, the specific focus on the very increased risk for those with predisposition towards mental illness or schizophrenia, depression. That is a trigger for about 1 in 9 in the population who are so vulnerably predisposed that we think is a strong warning sign that comes over and above on top of all the risks we've already fairly well identified. We are now seeing in the last 5 years of literature new warning signs that are deeper, more consequential, and more troubling than we'd seen before.
Do you have time for two other questions, or do you need to run?
I'm late for a meeting, I'm sorry to say, and let me take one more question, and I'll bail out. I'm already in trouble. Thanks.
Yeah.
Sorry.
The last question, I don't understand this. If the average potency is 8%, you also made the statement that it's increasingly likely that that the pot on the street will be more than 8%.
Yeah.
I guess, so I'm not sure. What's the average, I guess? Is the average 8% or is the average more than 8%?
There are two dynamics going on here. One is the share of the overall likelihood that someone will run into high-potency marijuana. That's a dynamic. When we do analyses of potency, there are low potency, and it's a certain share of the market, medium potency, a certain share, high potency. If you take them all together and just do a mean, a standard average of all of them together, that has been increasing steeply, doubling in the last 10 years up to 8%. But you can also see in the last 3 or 4 years another dynamic, which is the percentage of that which is seized on the streets that is below 3%, below 5%, above 5%, above 9%, above 15%, and the relative proportion of those has been shifting, and this ultimately will show up in subsequent years as a further increase in the mean. That is, the potency is likely to continue to rise because we're seeing a harbinger of that in the increased proportion of what's showing up on the street that is above 5%, above 9%, above 15% as very specially tailorized types of marijuana, Sinsemilla marijuana, BC Bud, the kinds of things that are grown in Amsterdam. As these become increasingly present in the market, it's steepening the rate at which the average overall potency is going up.
Okay, we're going to let you off the hook, but
thank
what
you.
Would be fantastic is if you had any backup, it's probably in our binder. I think what we just need to even understand is how do you increase THC, and we'll ask the next doctor.
Well, they do that by crossbreeding, but I think it's really important to leave you with one last fact.
Okay.
In the last 10 years, once again, we have seen a nearly 200% increase in the number of emergency room admissions mentions that are attributed to marijuana. That is exactly coincident with the steep rise in potency that we have seen. That is a strong correlation suggesting there is some new dynamic out there that people smoking high-potency cannabis and having untoward biological reactions leading them to an emergency room are going up together hand in hand. That should get our attention that we are facing a risk that we haven't fully apprehended in our policies as yet.
Particularly if they're all on Medicaid. Okay, thank you. Next, and I just mean that less because we pay the bill. I didn't mean that.
Sure. No, I understand.
Okay. Christy Willer, and you might be a doctor. Pardon me. Before that, we're going to have Dean Guanelli present the bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Just so I can apply this to all witnesses, I'm curious, I'm hearing the effects of pot on people, pot on health care costs, and if there's going to be statistics about... let's say, what a medical problem pot is becoming, the emergency room admission rate. Just so I have some context, I'd like that compared to the rate for alcohol, right? I mean, if we're saying that lots of people are showing up at the emergency room because of pot-related things, how does that compare to the number of people showing up at the emergency room because of alcohol? I'm just trying to get a sense of the relative seriousness.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is, for the record, my name is Dean Guanelli, Chief Assistant Attorney General with the Criminal Division of the Attorney General's Office. I appreciate the opportunity to come before you to talk about marijuana. It's an important topic. It's an important topic, I think, as Dr. Murray indicated, because of evidence that has just come to light really in the last decade or more, seeing the potency of marijuana increase, et cetera. I'd hoped to be able to give a brief overview before he started, but I wanted to get to him quickly, I wasn't able to do that.
Smart. I'm not sure that we're worthy of his testimony. We tried as hard as we could to get bits and pieces out of it. But
I understand.
Wow.
There was a lot that came through very quickly, and I appreciate him trying to get as much information to the committee in the time that he had available. Let me just say, we are going to present three other witnesses, and then I'd like an opportunity to speak again. Dr. Il Soli from the Mississippi Marijuana Potency Monitoring Project is calling in. Have Captain Ed Harrington from the Alaska State Troopers, who will tell us about marijuana and the way the troopers have found it, investigated it, trying to stop it in Alaska. Christy Willer from the Division of Behavioral Health, who will who's a clinician, many years of experience in Alaska and in rural Alaska, who will tell us about some of the disturbing things that that have come out of our own Department of Health and Social Services surveys about marijuana, marijuana use, and the tie-in between between marijuana and alcohol addiction, and how difficult it is to treat one while the other exists. but before we get to to the experts, I just want to put a couple things in context. I think it is important that we discuss marijuana. It's been a long time since the legislature has done so. The last time was when the legislature discussed medical marijuana. That was after the vote of the voters to allow small amounts of medical marijuana. And I just want to make it clear, this bill does not do anything to the medical marijuana law. It leaves those laws exactly as they are written, exactly as the legislature and the voters intended that that they be. And we are not intending to do anything to medical marijuana and the relationship between a patient and the patient's doctor. on the other hand, it really, other than medical marijuana, it has been over 20 years since the legislature has looked at the question of marijuana, and it was many years before that, before the Supreme Court decision in Raven. And I thought it would be it might be interesting. I mean, everyone talks about the Raven decision, and I just want to talk about it just for a couple of minutes, because you know, it's really part of the reason that we're here. I mean, it's in some circles a much maligned decision, and I just want to say that I kind of view the Raven decision in 1975 as having two important aspects. One is the aspect of how the court analyzed the law. In other words, the type of analysis. It had a constitutional right on one hand, and it had state interests on the other hand. And the constitutional analysis that the court applied in Raven was a balancing one rights with the importance of those rights with the state's interests. And that constitutional analysis really has been adopted by our court and by a number of courts over the years, and is really embedded in Alaska law. And we do not propose to change that. We are not arguing for change in the way the court. We are not going to advocate that the court change the way it analyzes those kinds of things, constitutional rights versus states' interests. The other part of Raven really was application of that balancing test to the facts that the court had before it. And in my view, the facts that the court had before it really were a product of its era, product of the early 1970s. Although the opinion came out in 1975, the case that gave rise to the opinion occurred in 1972, and the information the court had before it really was based on 1972 and 1973 scientific information. So it really was a product of its age, and it's not something that, I mean, we believe that if another case gets to the Supreme Court, it will be based on new facts. So the Raven case really is not the issue. I mean, we accept the court's analysis. It will just be applied to new facts. But I thought it might be interesting, because a number of you, when we visited a number of you before this hearing, expressed some interest in the Raven case. And I just want to focus your attention on a couple of things that the court said, because I think it would be important in assessing the facts. First thing the court said, going through the opinion, they say, quote, "Few would believe that they have been deprived of something of critical importance if deprived of marijuana." I agree with the court on that. I think part of the reason the court says that is because the experts who testified in the case, in the Raven case, in the early 70s, even the ones who testified proponents of marijuana, and some of the same people who've testified now, two weeks ago in Senate Hess, the court said the experts who testified below, including petitioners' witnesses, were unanimously opposed to the use of any psychoactive drugs. We completely agree. Again, something that it's hard to dispute what the court is saying. Even the experts are saying you shouldn't use these drugs. In fact, the experts who testified in Senate Hess said, This is not a completely harmless substance. There are some risks to using it. So it's hard to disagree with that aspect of the opinion as well. The court also.
Nelly, are you saying that Raven made a finding that marijuana wasn't harmful or wasn't very harmful?
Through the chair, what the court found was that the marijuana that existed in that era and the kind of marijuana that the court believed existed in Alaska in that era, that the state had not shown that it was sufficiently harmful to justify prohibition of use by adults in their own home. And what's critical in the opinion is what the court said was, quote, most marijuana available in the United States has a THC content of less than 1%. Now, I mean, that's important for a couple of reasons, because you just heard Dr. Murray talk about the increase in potency of marijuana. You will hear other witnesses talk about, it's one thing to talk about nationwide potency of marijuana. It's another thing to talk about what's available in Alaska. And you will hear other people talk about THC content in Alaska, on average, much higher than the national average. And what the court said, I mean, the court said, these are the facts the court had before it, less than 1% in Alaska. The court said further, we recognize that some more potent forms of cannabis other than marijuana are commonly used in other countries and are available on a limited scale here. However, studies of use patterns here do not indicate any great likelihood of a significant shift in use here to the more potent substances. If such a shift were to occur, then marijuana use could be characterized as a serious health problem. I think that's important for a couple of reasons. Even in 1975, even in that early era, the court in Raven discussed a lot of information showing that use of the more potent forms of marijuana and longer-term use had significant health effects. But what the court found was, we don't have that in Alaska. There's no indication that there's going to be a shift to that in Alaska. And so based on what we have in Alaska right now, or based on what we have in the United States today, we don't see that it's a significant health problem for adults using it within the confines of their home. Now, the proponents of marijuana who testified in Senate Hess.
Mr. Grinnell, you can go through the whole thing if you want, or it's your preference. If you want me to save the questions for the end, that's okay. It helps me to sort of address them as they come up during the testimony, whichever is you regret.
I'd be happy to hear the questions and then.
As they come up?
As they come up, certainly.
Okay. So the Raven Court said at the time they didn't think marijuana was sufficiently harmful to be banned. So I guess they found it was perhaps at some degree harmful, but not sufficiently harmful. And then your position has become more harmful now because it's more potent. And the only reference point I really have is alcohol. So I'm thinking one of the analyses in Raven is the court is saying you're allowed to use things that it deems are not sufficiently harmful for society to ban. And I guess if alcohol is not sufficiently harmful to ban because it's legal in the state, I'm interested in testimony that shows that pot use is more harmful than alcohol is. because that seems to be the standard that they might apply because they haven't banned the use of alcohol.
Through the chair, Representative Guerra, I kind of like Dr. Murray's analogy to dropping an anvil on your foot and maybe dropping a hammer on the other foot. Alcohol is a terrible problem in Alaska. No one's going to contend that it isn't. But that's not the standard by which the court is going to measure every substance that the legislature has a right to regulate. and part of the reason for that is that, that's not the legal standard. The legal standard is not taking the worst substance that you can imagine, and everything else has to be worse than that to be regulated. The court found a number of years ago that the state or municipalities certainly do have the right to ban alcohol. That's why we have the local option elections. That's why municipalities can choose to ban alcohol, and that has been upheld against a privacy challenge. But it's just not the case that that is the standard by which marijuana is going to be judged. However, saying that, I think that there is a tie-in between alcohol and marijuana, and you will hear other witnesses testify to that, particularly Christy Willer from the Division of Behavioral Health. And I believe the evidence will indicate that we are not going to get a handle on the alcohol problem in Alaska, particularly among alcoholics and people who significantly abuse alcohol, unless we also get a handle on marijuana, because there is a relationship between the two. The percentage of Alaska Natives in alcohol treatment, over 60% of Alaska Natives in alcohol treatment also have marijuana as a secondary drug of abuse. There is a tie-in between the two. It makes it more difficult to treat alcoholism when these other drugs are available and accessible. And to the extent that we have the courts or the legislature saying it's okay to have another type of drug in your house that you can abuse, that is going to make it more difficult
like
to treat.
Naltrexone, right? I think I recall some discussion about the fact that if someone is on marijuana or opiates, in addition to their alcohol addiction, for example, that they don't qualify for the therapeutic program that administers naltrexone, because for whatever reason, naltrexone doesn't work in those cases. I mean, that's just one example. Done.
And I recognize that. And alcohol is a significant problem in the state. I mean, one of the worst problems in the state. So I understand the point that we can regulate alcohol in the state, but ultimately what we're going to get down to is whether, since we're not making people felons if they use alcohol, should we make people felons if they use marijuana? And so that's ultimately what I'm keeping my eye out at.
Through the chair, this bill does not talk about use of marijuana. It talks about possession, talks about delivery, talks about having it in your car. To that extent, we're not talking about use. The one other point I wanted to mention in the Raven opinion before, if we could go to Dr. El-Soli.
So just but briefly on that point, so what you're trying to do in some senses is get around the NOI problem. I'm saying if you're in your own home and you're using marijuana, you're doing whatever you're doing.
Well,
but you're saying if you're manufacturing it, if you're delivering it to a minor, if you're driving, which I think is a terrible problem. Do you know this? I know of a case where an individual had marijuana on board in an automobile accident where the judge ruled that the admission of that evidence would be prejudicial to that driver. I think that is absolutely outrageous. But
Madam Chair, my response to Representative Guerra's question, and he had said, you know, we're making use of marijuana a crime, we're making possession a crime, and whether you possess it in your home or anywhere else, the voters in Alaska in 1990 made possession of marijuana anywhere in the state an offense. It is the courts that have put limits on affecting the voters' will. The last part of the Raven opinion I wanted to focus on is that, again, in 1975, the Raven court was looking to what was a National Commission on Marijuana from 1972, and it said, quote, "The National Commission rejected the notion that marijuana is physically addicting. It also rejected the notion that marijuana as used in the United States today presents a significant risk of causing psychological dependency in the user." You will hear evidence today that there is an organization called Marijuana Anonymous, like Alcoholics Anonymous, like Narcotics Anonymous, that is in existence in the majority of states in the country. The fact that that this country needs an organization to treat marijuana dependency, I think, is another indication that the facts that the court had before it in 1975 are significantly different than exist today. That was the last point I wanted to make about the Raven opinion. Dr. El Soli is on the phone. Captain Harrington is here. Christy Willer is here. And I'll be available afterwards because I have a couple other points that I'd like to make as a follow-up to their testimony. So,
Mr. Paul, thanks, Mr. Quillen. We went back and forth, but I guess I don't accept your explanation. I think dealing drugs is terrible and we should criminalize it. I think manufacturing it, criminalize it. I think possession with the intent to deliver, criminalize it. And those things are all on the bill, and I understand that. And then I said, but, and then my question, and this is I need to understand this as I analyze this bill. My question is, are you, apart from those people who deal, who make money off of drugs, it seems like your bill addresses something else, and that's the person who doesn't make money off of it, but who uses it in their home. And you said you're not punishing use, you're punishing possession. I don't understand what the difference is. Possession is like you've got it and you're not even using it. In fairness, the bill does make, maybe I'm wrong, maybe it doesn't make it a felony, maybe it's only making it a misdemeanor, let me know. But it seems that the bill does make it a felony, but correct me if I'm wrong, to have it in your home, even if you're not a dealer, even if you're not a manufacturer, even if you're not giving it to kids, even if you just have it there for yourself. I mean, this shouldn't be something we should be debating back and forth. Am I right? Am I wrong?
Madam Chair, Representative Guerra, I don't want to quibble over use and possession. Use to me as a lawyer means, you know, something that you've already taken into your system. Possession is something that you have it, it exists, it's in your home, it's accessible to your children, it's accessible to the neighbor's children. And the fact that marijuana exists in homes means that it is getting to children. Children in Alaska are using at a much higher rate than they used to. Many of them say that they can get it at home, and so possession in the home is a problem that needs to be addressed. And how exactly the legislature addresses that is up to the legislature. But possession in the home of a substance of the kind of potency that we've heard about already and we're going to hear about more that has the kind of effects that it has is a problem that I think the legislature ought to address. That's what we're here to present evidence on.
Just real quickly, too, what part? So the first part's the findings. Then we go into misconduct involving a controlled substance in the third degree. And I understand that. So you're raising that to 21 years old. That makes sense. The second part of your, I think, on page 5, line 19, that makes absolute sense that it used to be a pound. So you're saying it's 4 ounces. Where's the part of the bill, I guess, that is talking about what you and Representative are talking about, which is the heart of NOI? I mean, that's the heart of the fundamental. I mean, I think when it's all said and done, that's what it'll synthesize down to in the debate. I mean, I bet you if we went around this table that we would all agree that most if not all the findings are right on, that there's a danger to it, that we don't want kids to have it, that we don't want people selling it to kids, manufacturing it, making money off of it. We don't want people driving and operating aircraft while they are using it. But I think what we'll come back to is this thing of in your home and with Alaska's specific right to privacy, are we going to throw NOI out or not? And so where's that in the bill?
Madam Chair, it's on page 7, lines 19 to 21, and as I indicated, it is already against the law in Alaska to have, wherever it is, whether it's in your home or not, any amount of marijuana. Now, it says less than a half pound. That means more than a half pound becomes a Class A misdemeanor. This is a Class B misdemeanor. But it already exists in Alaska law. So I think that the debate that Representative Guerra and I are talking about really relate to the findings. And if the court, if the legislature makes these findings, and if those findings are upheld by the court, then the court is going to say the laws that have been enacted by the legislature are constitutional and they can be enforced. And there's a legitimate state interest in doing so. So really, I mean, the debate really is, Our existing state laws, the laws that were passed by the voters in 1990, can they be enforced by the state?
I appreciate that. It's an early morning, and it was a long night on elections.
And this is not an easy issue to get a grasp on because of the confusion caused by the various court opinions over the years.
Gira?
Sure. And I'm just going back to your response to my last question. You responded by saying, look, it's available to kids. Look, it's and when you make it available to kids, that's bad. And I agree with you. I mean, I think anybody who makes any drug available to a kid has done something that we should penalize. But that wasn't my question. My question is, it seems that at page 2, lines 6 and 19, and page 7, lines 19 through 21, it seems that you're also, in addition to punishing people who make it available to kids, and we should punish them, in addition to punishing people who do things under the influence of drugs, and we should punish them, in addition to people who manufacture, who possess, who deal, it seems like the way it's written, this also applies to an adult who has an ounce in their home who is not making it available to kids, who is not doing anything other than possessing it. Am I missing something? And that seems to be, and I agree with what Representative McGuire says, but that's going to be the nub of that's been the nub of Noy, isn't it? Whether or not you are allowed to possess it in your home, assuming that you're not also doing something like giving it to kids and driving under the influence and dealing and manufacturing.
Through the chair, Representative Guerra, you mentioned the Noy case. Noy was a man in the Fairbanks area who was found with marijuana in his home. He was having a summer barbecue, and there were friends and kids around, and the police, you know, were outside, and they smelled marijuana, and he ultimately allowed them to search his house and said, yeah, I've got it. He had marijuana all over his house. He had some growing in the basement. He had some in his front porch area in little containers. He had some in his master bedroom. He had some in an area. He had some that he had forgotten that it was there. He had it all over his house, and there were children. I can't remember whether it was his son or daughter living in the house, and there were children, you know, at the barbecue. I think we can debate whether someone ought to have a marijuana in their house. But the bottom line is, kids are going to get it. They're going to get it. They're going to look for it. And if it's there, it's going to be accessible to kids. If the legislature says it's okay for you to have it in your house, kids are going to think it's okay to have it in your house. And that's what this bill is trying to address. I mean, that's what the voters tried to deal with in 1990. We don't think that marijuana is appropriate. We think it sends the wrong message to say that it's okay to have it in your house. It is not okay to have it in your house. It causes problems. And that's what we're here to address. And I think we can debate how to do that. But I don't think it's right to say that, gee, you know, you have a few ounces in your own house and it's never going to cause problems. I think it does.
And let's continue this on. Let's get to the other folks online just out of courtesy to them, and then you'll hang around so we can continue this lively and stimulating debate.
Sorry, I can't make anybody answer my questions, Madam Chair. It's frustrating.
I know. Just keep at it. You'll get another shot. Okay. We have two more individuals and then some folks actually here in the audience. And my apologies if you're a doctor and it doesn't say that. There's only one person that has a doctor in front of their name. So Christy Willer, and again, if you're a doctor, my apologies.
Thank you, Madam Chair. No, I'm not a doctor, so that's perfectly all right. My name is Christy Willer. I'm the Deputy Director of the Division of Behavioral Health, and I'd like to share with you what I've learned about the use and abuse of marijuana in the state through that role, and also through my role as a treatment provider. Before this August, and for 16 years, I ran the drug and alcohol program for the Bristol Bay Area Health Corporation for 16 years for all of Bristol Bay, situated in Dillingham. So that's where also some of my information comes from. So I do have some firsthand knowledge of marijuana effects in a in one particular rural area of the state. You've heard from Dr. Murray and Mr. Grinnelli about the increasing THC levels in marijuana and nationally and also locally, but obviously of interest is what does that mean in terms of use and abuse in this state if you're a treatment provider. And what it means in general terms is that it's a much more strong, potent drug and dangerous drug than it was for those people smoking it at Woodstock. It's not as common parlance and common wisdom still has it, kind of the peace and love benign drug of the 60s. There are serious consequences to this increase in potency. For one thing, and I believe the doctor mentioned this juxtaposition, it seems as if the stronger stuff may have something to do with the fact that it's pushing more casual, often known as recreational users, into abuse and dependency on the drug. One indicator that, as reported in the Journal of the American Medical Association, in its prevalence of marijuana use disorders, they make the point that marijuana use has remained pretty much the same over the past 10 years nationally, but that rates of abuse and dependence among marijuana users has increased dramatically. And I believe Dr. Murray mentioned that too. Another indicator that more people are having more trouble with this drug use is that, as Mr. Grinnelli pointed out, there's now 29 states and 5 countries other than the U.S. in which marijuana anonymous chapters exist. In fact, in Los Angeles, there's 27 chapters alone in the city limits. A likely reason that more users are becoming problem users or experiencing problems with the drug is that the drug itself is stronger. And certainly if this is true nationally, where the overall THC content is, by some reports, on average 6.4%, we've heard 8%, the situation is probably worse in Alaska, where the levels have been reported on average much higher, 14% in 2004. I'm going to pause periodically because I know on teleconference, if I don't, nobody gets to say anything. So should I just continue?
Yeah, I just had a question, and I know you'd be the person to answer this. How do you define abuse? I understand dependency, but abuse, I mean, where is that line that someone's use crosses over into abuse?
Thank you, Madam Chair. That was actually my next point. I was going to go back and define my terms a little. In the DSM-4, in the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual of Mental Disorders that we take this terminology from, cannabis dependence requires, for somebody making an analysis or a diagnosis of that, dependence requires 3 or more of the following characteristics or behaviors. Tolerance to the drug, which means the need to have more of it to get the same results, the same high. Withdrawal symptoms, significant time seeking using, if your day is predominantly given over to acquiring the drug and using it. And interference with family or work or recreation, if this becomes a noted, discussed problem in the family. And a person's persistence of use despite obvious to him or her physical or psychological effects like coughing, red eyes, irritation, lung irritation, sedation. So that's a list of 5 things, 3 or more of which could lead a clinician to give a diagnosis of dependence. Abuse is 1 or more of the following. It's sort of a lesser stage of problem area, and you'd need 1 or more of the following 4 problems: an interference with school or work performance, using it while doing something physically hazardous, which, as you mentioned earlier, would be driving in my book, legal problems, or arguments with family members, spouses, children, or parents. So certainly a diagnosis, those terms are defined rigorously in the DSM. A good clinician, of course, would bring into play what brought the person into their office, but that's the definition that we go by. Did that help?
Representative, yes, it did, very much so. Representative Guerra?
Thanks, Ms. Willard. I've got some questions, too. The from what I've heard, there's the part of the effects of marijuana when somebody is under the influence, and I'm more curious about the impacts of marijuana on people after it's worn off. Can you discuss with me, for somebody who's dependent upon marijuana, what the conditions are that you treat people for, just as they relate to not when they're high, but after they're under the influence? I'm unclear as to what the lingering effect or the other ill effects are of marijuana when somebody's not high, I guess.
Okay, so a dependence would mean that actually not being high is the person's problem at that point. He or she wants to be high and is feeling withdrawal shakes or sleeplessness or irritation or irritability. They are needing to acquire more and more of the drug in order to feel reasonably normal. That's tolerance and withdrawal. They're not performing as well as they might have done in the past in terms of schoolwork or work or things like that. So it's the fact that their comfort level has now become situated in the hands of the drug. As an alcoholic, needs to acquire a kind of normal curve in their bloodstream in order to feel like they are who they are. So it's the acute symptoms of marijuana intoxication are gone, and that's what makes the person feel bad at that point.
Ms. Willard, just a follow-up. So you've got somebody who's dependent upon marijuana, we've got one other question on addiction, but I'll ask that in a moment. But you've got somebody who's dependent upon marijuana. After the drug wears off, there's some indication that they're performing worse, maybe at school or at work, you've indicated, or maybe I've misunderstood that. What is it when they're not under the influence of marijuana that's making them perform worse?
Well, if they're dependent, their attention is caught up in trying to get high again. A dependence means that the focus of their attention, their lives, their what they want to do with their time and their concentration is to get more of the drug and to use it.
And then I just have a question about when you say addiction or dependence, I don't know if you mean addiction. This is all new to me, and this is how I learn about drugs, is to sit on these committees. Is it established then that marijuana is addictive? That once you start using it to a certain level, then you become addicted to it, like you, or that you just become used to using it. I mean, how strong is the addiction to marijuana?
You know, I realize this is a word that I should know, but we've been using dependence and abuse so long, I don't know if that relates to words like addiction or not. I think that might be a non-medical terminology that people use that often simultaneously or synonymously with dependence, but I'm not really sure. I'd be happy to get back to you on that. But in other words, I think people would say, people would confuse the two, but I'm not even sure that, in fact, I don't think that the DSM has a cannabis addiction category. What I've given you is the two that I know about in terms of clinical diagnosis for marijuana.
Thank you very much.
Representative Crockhill.
Maybe one of the ways that you can help us, Christy, is how many adults at this point have you admitted into some kind of treatment for marijuana use?
Well, I have a state statistic that I believe Mr. Guinelli gave you a few minutes ago, that 34% of people who enter our public substance abuse treatment system in the state, which, by the way, costs us about $15 million. I think reference was given to the public funds going into this. Anyway, about 34% of them currently are being treated for a primary or secondary cannabis abuse or cannabis dependence diagnosis. And what that means, primary and secondary, means is that their cannabis is the presenting, the foremost primary problem that they're coming into our treatment programs with, or that is a secondary problem to some other substance, often enough alcohol. So these things are certainly hand in hand. They're not mutually exclusive or independent of one another in a lot of cases.
Representative Coghill?
And just for you in the Bristol Bay Area, you don't have to give me all the stats, but I would imagine that you're going to be dealing with people with co-occurring abuses.
Right.
But just for marijuana, is it? Have you ever treated somebody for abuse and put them in a treatment program just for the single use of marijuana?
Yes. Rarely, because often, as I mentioned, it's often enough as you said, co-occurring, but in coordination with alcohol abuse. But yes, especially among younger clients in our residential program out there, they would present more often solely with a marijuana problem.
Yeah, thank you.
Okay. Anything further?
For me, I did have some more testimony if you'd like me to go on.
There's one other person on the line that has a time constraint.
Okay.
Sure. Maybe, yeah, if we could go to Dr. El Soli just briefly, and then perhaps
stand by.
Back to Dr. Christy Willer.
Okay. Dr. El Soli, are you there?
Yes, ma'am. I'm here.
Okay. Why don't you go ahead and proceed with your testimony?
My testimony would be fairly brief since a lot of ground has already been covered. And I think I will limit my testimony to the potency. We have been talking about the increase in potency of marijuana, not only on the national level, but also in Alaska. And I think I can put a little bit more light on this issue and be glad to answer any specific questions related to that. I am a research professor at the University of Mississippi, where we actually have a program with the National Institute on Drug Abuse of analyzing marijuana samples that are seized by the Drug Enforcement Administration and also by the law enforcement agencies in the different states, especially in the eradication program. And so we have, over the years, we have been doing this program since 1970, actually in the 60s, in the late 60s, and we have monitored the average THC content of confiscated marijuana over the years, and I think quite a bit of the testimony that was made by Dr. Murray is from the data that we have in our program. And, for this testimony, I did prepare, looked at all the samples that we have analyzed over the years from the state of Alaska from 1976 all the way to 2004. I have the number of samples that we have received and analyzed, and also the average THC content or average potency of these samples, per year. I did provide the state with this particular graph, and they might already presented you with this, and if not, I'll be glad to provide it again, and also provided the data on the average level of THC in nationwide. And I can tell you that, obviously prior to 1985, we really had very small number of samples coming in from Alaska. In some cases, only in a year, we get only one sample in the 76, 77, 79. We only had one or two samples. But I think in the last few years, we have really begun to receive a lot more samples. And I can tell you that, maybe not going all the way back to the 70s or anything like this, but if you look at the data from 1980s, 1987, 88, and so on, all the way to till now, the average THC content in Alaska has not been less than 6%. And in some years, it's gone up to maybe 10 or 11, 12%, and some years it's gone up to maybe 14%, which is the highest in 2003. The number of samples for that year was 18 samples, and, you know, for 2004, we don't really have all the data in yet. There is only one sample that was analyzed in 2004. And the THC content on that sample is a little bit over 12%.
And we have that chart, Dr. Al-Suli. I'm looking at it right now.
Okay.
Well, can you get really basic for most of us that don't have a science background? How do THC levels occur? What is it about? There was some testimony that crossbreeding will produce a higher THC level. What is it that produces the higher THC levels?
There is actually two things, two major things that result in the change on the THC level. Number one is the genetic material. Just like any genetically produced crop that enhances the production of that particular crop, we have the same thing here with marijuana, where you can genetically select marijuana seeds that are coming from plants that are have the genes to produce high levels of THC. And so by a process of practice and elimination and selection, you can actually have seeds or plants that you know have very high level of THC. And then the other thing about marijuana also is that it could be vegetatively propagated. So if you find one plant that you know this plant has very high THC content, then you can vegetatively propagate that plant. You make cuttings out of that plant, and you bring those cuttings up, and you produce a second generation, daughter plants, if you will, out of that plant, and those plants, the new plants now, will have the same THC, the same cannabinoid, the same chemical composition as the mother plant. And so number one is the genetic selection. But then number two is also the fact that marijuana is, the THC content is present in some glandular hairs, structures that exist on the leaves of the plant. The larger the leaf is, the less the concentration of THC in the leaf, because if you can consider that the amount of THC per leaf is pretty much the same, then as the leaf gets bigger, it has a lot more cellulose and biomass that, you know, relative to the THC, and therefore the THC content in that leaf will be low. However, as you get closer into the smaller, the young leaves, and particularly the leaves that surround the female flowers of the cannabis plant, the concentration of those hairs on those leafy structures is so much that by weight you have a lot more THC relative to the weight of that small leaf than you have with the large leaves. And therefore the second factor that leads to the increase in potency is the selection of what type of material you harvest. Mm-hmm. If you harvest the whole entire marijuana plant, big leaves, small leaves and all, you are not going to have as much THC percent in that harvested biomass as you would if you just take the buds.
Okay, and then I know Representative Gehr has a question, but just in final follow-up on this, what is it then, because I was sitting here thinking there are two areas of our state that tend to or are reputed to have healthy crops of marijuana. The Matanuska Valley is one that people talk about, and then kind of the North Pole, Fairbanks area. And I was thinking that perhaps it had something to do, like any kind of crops, it had something to do with the soil, the weather, the, you know, those types of factors. So just an answer on how environment may or may not increase or if it has anything to do with THC. And then the second is why then in Alaska are the THC percentages going up so dramatically, and are they going up dramatically in other states?
To answer the first question in terms of the environment is is important for the growth of the plant, but it doesn't really affect the the production of the THC per se. I think we can have here in Mississippi, you know, plant material that is just as good as the one produced in Burbank. So the environment, so long as the temperature conditions and the soil and the fertilizers and so on are made available to the plant is going to produce. And so the most the most important factor here in getting the potency would be the genetic material of the plant. So I think maybe in your area there has been some selection of high potency material that is grown in your area. But the second thing, it's possible that there might be some indoor growing more predominant in your area than it is, you know, for example, in the south here.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
And indoor growing, you have a lot more control over the, you know, the temperature, the humidity, the, you know, the light conditions and so on, which could be ideal for production of good biomass. And then also there is one other factor, and that is in terms of the production, you can have plant material, as I indicated, you can vegetatively propagate. You can make a selection where you only have female plants. Mm-hmm. And those female plants produce a variety known as Sensimella.
No men needed. No male plants, huh?
I'm sorry?
No male plants are needed, huh?
No male plants are needed. Female plants are the ones that have the highest THC content. That's not to say that male plants don't have it, but they just don't have as much. They are not as good as the female plants in producing THC. And that has a lot to do with these tiny leafy structures known as the bracts that surround the female flowers, and they have a high concentration of the hairs that have the THC.
Representative Guerra.
So it's the female plants that create all the trouble.
Yes.
Doctor, a couple questions. I take it THC is the part of the marijuana that I guess primarily leads to the high and the effect. Is that why we're focusing on THC?
Yes, sir. The potency of the marijuana plant is directly and basically solely dependent on the THC content.
Okay, I'm just trying to understand this. How quickly does higher potency THC make you get a quicker high? Do you get the high quicker with the higher potency THC?
It's just like the dose. It's a dose. It's like giving an injection of whatever medication. That the small dose is not going to give you as much effect as the higher dose. And smoking marijuana, there is, the danger in marijuana when it comes to being subjected to the high-potency material really lies in the fact that there's a little bit of delay between the smoking and then getting that high. You know, and the delay, I'm not talking about, you know, hours or anything. It's just it's a minute or 2 minutes or something. So, but within that minute or 2 minutes, one could actually inhale one or two or three puffs that would deliver such a high amount of THC that the person really wouldn't have, you know, given the time. And that might have something to do with the people that are have the experience with marijuana. They will probably know how to maybe titrate a little bit better than somebody that really just, practicing with this drug and just being exposed to high-potency material unknowingly that it's high-potency or even what to expect. So the THC is just a matter of how much drug you're actually getting, and therefore the high gets higher as the THC content gets higher. But also one other factor that didn't come up in any of the other testimonies that I heard, today is that THC is a drug that has what we call a biphasic effect. Biphasic effect meaning at low dose you get some effect, at a high dose you get the opposite effect. And so if somebody that is experiencing with marijuana and they really don't have a good grasp on what to expect and so on, if they use a small amount, let's say the early low potency material, they might get the high, the euphoria, and the pleasant effect of the drug. But then as the person gets much higher level of the drug, then they get into the the opposite effect, which is paranoia, restlessness, irritation, violence, and so on. So the increase in the potency of the material and the possibility of someone using much higher dose than they really need to just to get the high could have a much opposite effect on the individual.
Doctor, just and I'm trying to understand this THC thing a little bit more. So let's say you've got two people, and one person has a low THC cigarette, and one person has, one that's twice as potent. And you're talking about the two, three, 5 minutes. In that five-minute period, will the person who's smoking the more potent one be more high after those 5 minutes, or does it take a much longer time than that?
No, absolutely. It actually, the highest high, one achieves on the highest blood level is achieved before the cigarette is finished. So within the 10 minutes is really when you get the peak of the high.
So I guess what I'm leading to is this then. I wasn't sure about what the answers were to that, but it seems to me that apart from the person who's completely and terribly addicted, it seems to me that if you're going to get much more high off higher dose THC, you're just going to use less. I mean, why? So what's the big danger of it being more potent? If a higher THC cigarette gets you more high quicker, don't you just use less?
Well, you could. I mean, theoretically, yes. But the problem is you don't really know how much is you got, and it's too late once you inhale it. It's too late. You already had however much, and you don't know how much you inhaled until you actually get the effects, and it'd be too late to take it back. That's the problem. And you see the difference is if you take, for example, the similarity would be with alcohol, if you take a shot of just a drink, and if that drink has 6% alcohol, you're not going to get much of an effect. But if that drink has 50 or 60% whiskey or something, and you take that shot, you're going to have a much bigger effect. The difference between alcohol and marijuana in that regard is that you can probably just taste the drink while it's still on your tongue and realize that this is a high alcohol content drink versus a low alcohol content drink. That is not the case with marijuana because most of the smell and the flavor and all these things that are associated with the smoke before it actually gets into the lungs and goes into the bloodstream and goes to the brain are related to non-THC components of the plant material. So a low-potency cigarette and a high-potency cigarette would basically taste the same. That's another part of the problem.
That's a very good point. I hadn't thought of that. Representative Coghill?
First of all, I have to object to this question because he took all my questions.
Oh.
Except for this. Doctor, when we see the percentages, you related to the percentage of alcohol, and in the question of whether you used it less often because it's more potent. We also have other scales, like the Richter scale, for example, is in multiples. And can you give us some idea of when you're talking about percentage? Do you measure it by blood level? Can you give us, you talked about this biphasic effect. Is there a tipping point in your view? Is it measured by blood level or the THC in the cigarette?
Well, they are very intimately related. The THC level in the blood is going to be proportional to the THC level that you have in the cigarette. And this is, this is scientifically proven. If someone smokes a cannabis marijuana that has 2% THC versus 4% THC versus 8% THC, you're going to see the blood levels over time, much higher for the 4 than the 2 and much higher for the 8 than the 4 and so on. So it is proportional. The amount of THC that actually get into the bloodstream is dependent on how the person actually smokes the cigarette and the holding time of the smoke in the lungs and giving it a chance to be absorbed and goes into the bloodstream. So So the experience also has something to do with that. You could have someone as an outlier, someone that is using a 4% cigarette versus someone using 2% cigarette, someone that just smokes and doesn't really inhale that much of the 4% versus someone that inhales and keeps it and holding it with the 2%, it's possible for the 2% to give you higher blood level than the 4%. So it's a matter of the practice and the use pattern and so on. But it's directly related to how much THC actually got into the lungs and absorbed into the bloodstream.
And then what on these methods and things, I mean, we all know from movies and things, bongs or cigarettes or different devices that you use. Can you just give a tiny little sketch of which of those are worse in terms of getting the drug or the THC part of the drug directly into your system?
I think they're all equally bad. The practice of how the person actually uses those devices is what results in how much THC gets into the bloodstream.
Okay. So it's not the device, it's...
No, the device is just a way of, the people's preference of which device they use, but the ultimate effect is related to how much THC actually goes from the smoke into the lungs.
Okay.
I just want to make one comment relative to the potency and so on. I believe you only have the graph that shows the normalized average for non-normalized average for THC nationwide. And of course for 2004, again, it's approaching the 8% that Dr. Murray talked about. We still don't have all the data, so we're not really sure what that number will be when we get all the 2004 numbers in there. But my guess it would be right around maybe 7%. Now, if you look at this curve here is really composed of two sets of samples. One set of samples that are coming from the domestic cannabis eradication program, all from the different states here in the states. And then we have a lot of samples that are seized that we don't really know what these samples are coming from, and we presume those to be largely from foreign countries. And if you look at the numbers, the THC content of the domestic samples, they have been all the way from 1985, starting right around 2%, and in 2003, they're right around 4%. So the domestically produced marijuana here in the U.S. on the average right now these days in the last 2, 3, 4, 5 years or so, it's right around 4%, give or take a little bit. And so when you look at the Alaska samples, they are much, much higher than the national average of the domestically produced materials. In other words, the increase in the THC content in the national scene is not because of the domestic production being high, but rather because we are beginning to get samples from outside the U.S. that are actually higher potency than we used to get before.
Okay, and Representative Anderson, and then Representative
Hira. Hi, Doctor. Thank you for your testimony. And I know we're running out of time, so I'll be brief, and if you could be brief in your response. But
yes, sir.
I've had a few constituents write, of course, the threats this morning. I chuckled. A couple said, if you vote for this bill, we won't vote for you in the next election. They're that adamant on the issue. And with those who add more to the body of their emails, they cite that, hey, the worst thing you can get with marijuana is, euphoria, you're hungry, you're lethargic. And of course, we hear this, we see this. But the bottom line is, could you say on the record what the three negative things are? I even know I can see in the audience, I'm sure there's folks that are opposed to the bill because they condone the use. But can you state for the record the three things that you say are the worst about marijuana, aside from the fact that maybe you feel good or you have hunger? I don't know if those are good things or bad, but what are the things that make you endorse this legislation, the three worst effects?
Well, number one, the dependency that Ms. Willard talked about, and the negative effect not only on the health but also on the performance of the individuals, that's one. The fact that the emergency room visits increase in the 12 to 17 year olds you know, over the years have really gone up too high. As a matter of fact, it's probably more than both, you know, alcohol and other drugs, you know, combined for treatment for addiction. And then the amotivation syndrome that results from the young people using the drug at an earlier age, and these kids, they don't want to do much, they don't want to be involved, they don't want to be social, they have the tendency to want to be, you know, by themselves and not really, you know, motivated to do anything at all.
Okay.
And then the other thing, when it relates to the operation of the you know, motor vehicles or any machinery that requires a lot of attention, there is a tremendous deficit in the you know, sense of time and reaction time and judgment that is negatively impacting. And marijuana now is associated with a lot of the highway fatalities. Not necessarily that the person dies, but they die from accident as a result of not responding on time or being alert as they are driving the vehicle.
Perfect. That's exactly what I needed to know. Thank you.
Thank you, sir.
Thank you very much. Representative Guerra?
Doctor, you just talked about your analysis of the THC level. What kind of, like, statistical sample have you used? How much have you analyzed from Alaska?
I can tell you the number of samples, you know, you give me a year, a particular year, I give you the number, but I can tell you from 1996, we had 21 samples, 97, 25, so you have the graph, and I think the numbers on top of the graph is the number of samples, not the graph, but the barograph, that is. The number on top of the barograph is the number of samples analyzed from Alaska for that year.
Thank you.
Yes, sir.
Thank you so much, Dr. Elsely.
My pleasure.
Your testimony was invaluable.
Thank you very much.
Appreciate your time.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. Okay. Christy, you want to wrap up briefly, if you don't mind? We've just got 15 minutes, and we've got a few more folks here.
Okay. Let's see. I will kind of cut to the chase then. This is Christy, Madam Chairman. Thank you very much. I guess I'd like to emphasize then that in addition to the effects of trivializing or underestimating the negative consequences of this drug use, it affects the attitudes about risk of using it, and we know that attitudes about risk affect not only adults, but certainly the children that they influence, and there's some statistics that associate with parental use in homes and then children's the amount of children's use associated with that, which I won't go into detail because of the time. The other point I'd like to make is that age of first use appears to have really grave consequences. So again, related to children's use, if marijuana is easily accessible in a household, there's a greater likelihood of dependence later in life for kids who try it out before the age of 15. There's a greater likelihood of heroin and cocaine use later in life. The children are less likely to graduate. They're more likely to be involved in delinquent or deviant behaviors. They're more likely to have multiple sexual partners, including a risk of HIV. So there are grave consequences about young people using, and for kids in this state, we have a particular problem. One in eight high school students reported using marijuana before the age of 13 in a 2003 Alaska Youth Risk Behavioral Survey. Excuse me, and in a regional survey, over 10% of middle school participants reported using marijuana before the age of 11. So in this state, there is a risk for young people. They are using it younger. Alaska Native youth are even at more risk than their non-Native friends.
Are you able to find out, Christy?
That same Alaska Youth Risk Behavioral Study, it showed that relative to non-Natives, Native kids were using at a rate of 69.7 relative to 41.2%. So our kids are at risk. Our Native kids are at risk even more. The argument certainly that marijuana use relative to alcohol and tobacco use in this state is a valid one, I think. I share the impression that alcohol and tobacco are more deadly. I also, however, don't think that adding marijuana to the mix is really beneficial. As I mentioned before, a lot of people come into our treatment programs with a marijuana problem associated with alcohol problems. And as a treatment provider, it was clear to me out there that people struggling to recover from alcoholism often enough shared the common wisdom that a lot of us in this country share, that this is, that marijuana is a benign high, that it's a free way to get high without consequences, and folks would try to face their struggle with recovery from alcoholism by getting stoned and would wind up going right back to alcohol because their tolerance would be down and it would lead them back into alcoholism. So there's a complementary, a negative complementary effect that was detrimental. So summarizing, marijuana today is stronger than it ever was, leading to more dependence and abuse. Kids are trying it at younger ages, particularly because it's accessible in their homes and because we tend to think of it as not a risky drug. And these issues are hitting our most vulnerable populations hardest. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Ms. Willer. Just one quick question. In the survey that you took the percentages of kids that had tried it before 11 and 14 and so on, did you ask a question about where they were getting it? Do you know?
Let me see. I do have some numbers on that about getting it from their homes. Hold on just a sec. In a national study on drug use in 2003, this is a national study, 53.6 young people, percent of the young people said that marijuana was easy to obtain. 48% got the marijuana from their own homes, and 13.3% got it from a family member or relative. So there was a lot of access in their own homes.
I don't know if it's your division or who puts together those surveys. We've certainly debated about those, haven't we, in schools. But right. You might consider on an updated version asking that question of Alaskan students.
On the other studies I mentioned, yes, I think that's an excellent idea if it hasn't been done already.
I mean, that is where the link has to be made between that the person's right, if you will, to use and have marijuana in their home. Where does the legitimate government interest come in? And I think questions surrounding kids having access to it in the home is at the heart of it.
Yep, I agree.
Thank you very much. Okay, next we have four more people. We have Ed Harrington from the Troopers, and my apologies, I don't know if it's Lieutenant or
Captain.
Okay, Captain Harrington.
Good morning. For the record, I'm Ed Harrington. I'm a captain with the Alaska State Troopers. I've been with the Troopers for about just shy of 24 years. Nine of those years, I worked in the Drug Enforcement Unit, ending in about 1995. During three of those 9 years, I was assigned to the Matsu Unit, where I did pretty much exclusively marijuana eradications, commercial grow eradications. I was also the statewide coordinator for marijuana eradication during those years for DEA and reported the results of marijuana seizures to the University of Mississippi and Dr. El Soli's project. I wanted to talk about a couple things here. First off, just a couple cases that came to my attention here recently. One was a six-year-old boy that we interviewed at a active methamphetamine lab. And during that interview, he told the investigators that his girlfriend's boyfriend was teaching him how to smoke marijuana by using a bong. Also, there was a 11-year-old boy here recently. They got stopped. A 17-year-old boy in high school. They got contacted with marijuana in the school. And when he was questioned, he stated that his mother taught him to smoke marijuana when he was 13. And provided him with marijuana up until her death a couple years before when he found her dead in the parking lot from an OxyContin overdose. And these cases are kind of interesting because it shows where these kids can obtain their marijuana from their, the adults that they live with or are around. I wanted to talk a little bit about commercial marijuana grows. I know there's a lot of discussion about 4 ounces of marijuana, and I think a lot of people have a kind of a vision of people growing small amounts of marijuana, 2 or 3 plants in a backyard or in a closet, you know, under a grow light that you might buy at Fred Meyer's. And I can tell you those kind of grow sites are out there, but my unit, the drug unit, rarely comes across those. The people we're dealing with are commercial marijuana cultivators. They put a lot of effort into growing this marijuana. It's not just a simple thing of providing a small light and a couple of seeds. To start off with, they clone the marijuana plants, much like Dr. Al-Soli mentioned during his discussion. They'll take a very mature, viable female marijuana plant, and they'll take a snip off that plant and clone those leaves. And what that does is that gives them a clone of the mother plant. It's a female plant. They don't have to sex the plant. So when we go to these grows, we find strictly female plants that are going to produce the flowering top of the bud of the plant, which is the most sought-after product. They will, you know, they don't, they have to go into a room and turn it into a grow room. And so they'll line the walls with visqueen, punch a hole through the wall for ventilation so they can get the air out. They buy sophisticated lighting equipment. Oftentimes they'll put them on tracks so the light tracks back and forth across the room to provide the light to the plants. They have CO2 generators, air purifiers, nutrients, fertilizers, all of those type of things to grow the marijuana. Generally at these commercial grow sites, we find the marijuana in 3 stages of growth. It's very common. That's one of those things we look for to establish it as a commercial grow site. And the reason they grow marijuana in 3 stages is that they always have their cash crop coming up and available for sale. And those 3 stages are the budding stage, which is where the plant is mature, fully mature and ready for harvest. The middle stage is the vegetation state. During that state, the plant is putting on the bulk of its vegetation and its vegetable mass. And then you have the starter state where the plants are just starting to grow, where they've been cut usually from the mother plant. And we find that in almost all of our grow sites. Kind of another myth out there that I wanted to talk about was I've heard a lot of discussion about people going to jail for possessing small amounts of marijuana. And I can tell you from my experience that's a fallacy. I mean, we can hardly get people much jail time that are convicted of growing large quantities of marijuana. We recently had a case here where there's a grow of 86 plants, which is a commercial grow, obviously, and that case was dismissed right at the court level. The case was never even prosecuted because of the caseloads and the parts of the district attorney's office. So. And the people that are convicted for these grows, usually they get a suspended imposition of sentence. If there's any jail time, it's very minimal, 2 or 3 months maybe at that. And frequently, when we've had the occasion, I've actually gone back to seize property where we've grown marijuana or seized marijuana in the past. And 6 or 9 months later, when we go back to seize that property, they're actually growing marijuana again in the same residence.
Do you think that has to do with an overall kind of societal or community attitude about marijuana in Alaska? If you were growing that many plants in another state, would that be something that would be prosecuted?
I believe it would, and I think that's the case. You know, we get a different sentence if the marijuana grower reaches a federal threshold, which is generally 100 plants. We can look at more severe penalties. There's a case here I'm going to talk about real briefly that we're presenting to the feds, and probably they'll be looking at 5 years in federal jail if they're convicted of that offense.
Are these folks sophisticated enough that they know to keep it under 100?
Yes, they are. Actually, when I was working in the Valley, DEA at the time started to raise their threshold to 100 plants, and we started finding a number of marijuana grows that were specifically under 100 plants, 90, 95, things like that. I wanted to talk a little bit about the cost of marijuana in South Central. You know, Anchorage to Fairbanks, ounce of marijuana sells for $350 to $400 per ounce, about $4,000 a pound. That's a wholesale price. You know, recently we just purchased three marijuana joints in rural Alaska. We paid $100 for those. That was probably less than a gram. Most joints are a quarter of a gram, so you can get a four joints out of a gram of marijuana. If you correlate that out, $100 for a gram, that would equate to $2,800 per ounce, $45,000 for a pound if it's sold in joint quantities in rural Alaska. Another example is we bought 3 grams for $100. That equates to about $15,133 per pound. So you can see there's quite a profit margin in just a pound of marijuana. If you took 4 ounces of that amount and sold it out there, it would be worth $3,700.
Jeez.
We did a research.
4 ounces equals $3,700?
Yes.
Representative Guerra?
I'm somewhere close to on the fence on this, on this issue of whether people should be able to possess small amounts. And you had mentioned, and the one thing that people keep saying to me is we don't have the law enforcement to prosecute sexual assaults and things like that. Why do we think that making more crimes is going to result in something beneficial? And so you had made the point that you had a case that the prosecutors dropped of relating to a grower because they just didn't have the resources to do it. So this is a tough question, but I'm asking you, if we're going to make more crimes and more criminals and the prosecutors didn't have the resources to prosecute a grower in that case, how is this going to result in something other than more unprosecuted cases?
Through the chair, that particular case was unusual, being dismissed by the DA's office, and I don't know the parameters around it. I think that kind of gets to the overall acceptance of marijuana in the state of Alaska, the prosecution of those kind of cases. And I think to really address part of the solution of addressing the marijuana problem in Alaska is to more aggressively prosecute those cases and make those sentences harsher for those people that are actually dealing and selling marijuana on a commercial basis.
You don't have to answer this unless you have a comment on it. It seems to me that the grower issue is much more serious, and I'm wondering maybe we should just focus on that.
Well, it is a serious issue, but I guess one point I want to make is you can have a commercial grower that's manufacturing anywhere from 5 to 2,000 plants, and I mentioned 5 because just 2 days ago we had a case where there were 5 marijuana plants seized that were being grown for commercial production. The plants were in a progressive growth cycle. There was a pound of marijuana in the freezer. And this particular grow came to light because two 17-year-old boys got in a fight in school over an amount of marijuana. And so, yeah, we have to address those commercial growers. The problem we're having now with commercial growers due to the Noy decision in Crocker, we used to be able to get a search warrant on the smell of marijuana, and when you can smell freshly grown marijuana, once you smelt that, it becomes a pretty familiar smell to you. And so we would be able to get a search warrant based on that level of probable cause. Well, now with the Crocker decision, we have to be able to articulate that we know there's more than 4 ounces of marijuana being grown in that residence, and that's a real high threshold for us to reach. You know, there's only like 20, 25 drug investigators in the state, and it's hard for them to spend a large amount of time on some of these grows to prove that there's more than 4 ounces of marijuana being grown in the residence. I had a couple of, just to give you an example here quickly, the number of marijuana plants that we've eradicated over the years. In 1999, which was one of our highest years, we eradicated 14,600 marijuana plants. In 2003, that number had dropped to 5,200. And last year, in 2004, that number had dropped to 3,900. And a big part of that is due to the Crocker-Noy decision. In addition to that is the increase in methamphetamines as well. The Matsu Valley, which used to do 80% marijuana grows, are now doing about 80% methamphetamine labs.
Well, I just had in response to Gara to kind of help you contour a response, and I don't blame you if you're not wanting to give them because we get into the policy analysis, and I think you're talking here in testimony about law enforcement, but isn't it true that if you look at legislation over the last, let's say, decade, whether it be domestic violence, definitely curbing DUIs and drinking and having tougher penalties, selling to minors for drinking, meth labs, coke, ecstasy, go down the line. Isn't this legislation, even though you're here for the law enforcement aspect, isn't it in parity with all those others versus saying, well, we'll give a pass on the marijuana smokers because courts are clogged and, you know what, at this point we won't worry about that. I mean, isn't the idea to be consistent in all drug use until it's legalized?
Through the chair, yes, that would be my opinion.
Anything further?
So there.
Okay. Thank you very much, Captain. We have two more people. We have to go to the floor. We have two more people, Aaron Mattingly and Patrick Sheehan. I don't see your names. Aaron Mattingly.
Matley.
Okay. Go ahead.
Excuse me for reading, but it just helps me consolidate my time to best say everything I want to say.
Representative Garrett?
Are we gonna have more hearings on this?
Yeah,
if these folks are local, could they come back? But it's up to them.
It's my second time coming back, and I've already paid money out of my own pocket to be here. It cost me money to be here.
From out of state?
If we can
I have to not be at work.
Okay, sure.
Yeah.
And if we could also have a copy of your written testimony when you're, if you want us to, when you're done.
I do.
You just make copies.
However, I've started writing notes on my final draft.
Sorry, you could submit it later if you wanted
to. Clarifications. Okay. Well, I'd just like to say, again, for the record, my name's Aaron Mattingly. I'm a registered voter, and I'm a marijuana user. I've used it for 8 years. During this time, I've excelled in a lot of aspects in life. College sports, varsity cross country, and varsity soccer. I'm not saying that's a performance enhancer, but I am saying it's simply managed in one's life according to one's goals. My fastest time in cross country was 5 miles in 28 minutes and 30 seconds. I've climbed 14,000 foot peaks. I know Denali guides that partake in cannabis. I'm a former president of college music organization that was featured at my university's president dinner. I have a design patent in process. I'm a wood crafter. I'm an outdoorsman. I have 3 music CDs I've released and 1 independent film that can be ordered at www.groovyfilms.biz. I have a steady lady friend of 2 years who does not smoke pot. I think that's very important. She does not smoke pot. I have my bachelor's degree in professional accounting. I currently work for the state of Alaska as a junior auditor in legislative audit. But I am not here representing legislative audit. I'm here representing myself. You know, I'm not being paid right now. I could lose my job if I were. So for that record, I'm representing myself. It's costing me money to be here right now. And I think that democracy is weakened when people have to decide between participating in a democratic process or paying for rent and putting food on the table. I'm fortunate enough that I can make the sacrifice. My expertise credentials root from my direct involvement with the cannabis culture in the lower 48 and the Great AK, a culture that has been demonized by government propaganda. I, like everyone here at the table, am for regulation of marijuana in order to keep children under the age of 18 from using it and adults under 21 from using it. Let's regulate it. However, I'm strongly opposed to House Bill 96 and Senate Bill 74. These bills are not about keeping marijuana away from children or increasing the wellness of society. They only create disharmony and are part of an ongoing effort to oppress a natural resource that undermines big money and special interests, i.e. fossil fuels, timber, petrochemicals using nylon, and oil-based products such as plastic, pesticide consumption by genetically engineered food companies with 10,000 seed patents. There is more money being made in pretending that we're stopping marijuana use than there is selling it. Quick example, myself and two friends were fined over $3,500 for a $35 bag of weed. Plus, there are privatized prisons knocking on Alaska's door for the per prisoner revenue amount, while Senate Bill 56 gives judges the ability to increase felony sentencing, i.e. nonviolent marijuana activists. There is more money being made in pretending that you're stopping it than there is selling it. Shame on the political feel of these bills. All the information and research needed to support the legalization of marijuana has already been presented countless times before, despite marijuana research, independent, unmarginalized research, being barred from universities as federal governments produce propaganda from White House experts. You know, yeah, they contract universities to produce research, but again, it's contracted, it's very marginalized. I am coming from that. I believe that the burden of proof, there is so much already, there's so much research out there that already supports legalization of marijuana and regulation of it, that the burden of proof actually lies on the proponents of these desecrated bills. The facts stand why marijuana should be legalized, and let's start with a patriotic one. Benjamin Franklin started one of America's first paper mills with cannabis. This allowed America to have a free colonial press without having to beg or justify paper and books from England. You can find all this in a book that I'm quoting. It's called The Emperor Wears No Clothes. It's by Jack Herrera. Some people will consider it just cultural propaganda. However, is an authoritative document. Further, uses of marijuana are as follows. Cannabis used to make over 25,000 products before it was outlawed in 1937. 125 years ago, 70 to 90% of all rope, twine, cordage, ship, sails, canvas, fiber, cloth, etc. was made out of hemp fiber. In 1937, it was replaced by DuPont's newly discovered petrochemical fiber known as nylon. Cannabis was the number one annually renewable natural resource for 80% of all paper, fiber textiles, and fuel from 6,000 years ago until 125 years ago. Cannabis was used for 5 to 50% of food, light, land, and soil reclamation, and even 20% or more of all medicine. Prior to the 1800s, hemp seed oil was the number one source for lighting oil throughout the world. Until 1937, 38, even paints and varnishes were 80% hemp seed oil. Hemp seed oil is non-toxic and has been used to make high-grade diesel fuel, oil aircraft, and precision oil. The pulp from hemp is the most efficient, sustainable source of plant pulp or biomass fuel to make charcoal, gas, methanol, gasoline, and electricity in a natural way. Nutritionally, hemp seed is the most perfect.
You off, but if that's something in an article that you could just leave with us, we'd be appreciative. I'm running
okay.
A very delicate balance
that's
here
fine.
As the
that's
chair because I'm extremely appreciative of your testimony. We're supposed to be on the
well,
floor.
Well, then I'll move on. This is fine, but you did allow
And I understand that, and
to...
I'm trying to be respectful of you as well.
So as you can see, there's a long history. This is not they say these up and coming research in the last 5 years. So I'd like to go back to this part, which is not from an article. And I'd like to bring up a bill that was voted on not too long ago, and a quote by, forgive me if I pronounce his last name wrong, Bruce Wyrock. Wyrock. You guys were discussing the bill on whether or not it would be a criminal offense to act in a government position to line your own pockets with money, and he said, why $5,000 with more than, you cannot, it'd be a criminal offense to line your pocket with more than $5,000 acting upon a government official in a stance. So he says, why $5,000? Why not $4,000? It doesn't make sense. There's a lot of holes in it. He voted no. So he voted to say, like, yeah, you guys can go ahead and act and line your pockets with money, and it won't be a criminal offense. So with marijuana, why 4 ounces? It's really arbitrary.
The challenge to the world and this committee is to try to prove the facts wrong. If all fossil fuels and their derivatives, as well as the deforestation of trees for paper and agriculture, are banned from the use in order to save the planet and reverse the greenhouse effect, then there is only one known renewable resource able to provide the overall majority of our paper, textiles, and food, meet all the world's transportation, home, and industrial needs, reduce pollution, rebuild the soil, and clean the atmosphere all at the same time, or stand our old standby that did it before, cannabis and hemp. I'd like to, I'm a captain as well. I make captain skateboards. And I'd like to comment on this $100 gram that in the previous testimony. That's a joke. Nobody would pay $100 for a gram. That's a bull. People would kick that down. He's taking government money and pushing it in some dealer's face. Yeah, if he wants to give you $100 for a gram,
he'll take
$200.
He's talking about Bush, Alaska, the fact that, you know, you could talk about a gallon of milk is $10 in Bush, Alaska.
Right, but it's still not fair market value. It's not even black market value.
I'm going to ask you to wrap up now.
Okay.
And my apologies.
I'd like to remind the committee that 43% of voters voted to regulate marijuana, and that these two bills are an extreme, harsh swing. You guys rely high on expert testimony versus public testimony. This is not a country of the experts, for the experts, by the experts. It's of the people. Nothing is completely harmless. This is also an attack on freedom of speech. My breath is my speech. Take away my breath, takes away my speech. I have the ability to inhale and exhale smoke from my breath. If you guys had a choice between being locked in a room full of marijuana smokers and a running car, I believe most people would choose marijuana smokers, otherwise you'd be dead. So, I like to say, this is not an issue of health and wellness, because we agree, someone as myself who is a user, agrees that we need to regulate marijuana in order to keep children under the age of 18 and adults on the age of 21. We need to regulate it. We don't need to make more criminals here. It's absolutely ridiculous, and I say again that this bill is actually, on a macro level, protecting big money. Thank you for allowing me to testify.
I just want to say something.
And I'll accept questions.
I sincerely appreciate your testimony. I agree with you. And one of the things we do in Judiciary Committee on a bill this size, we'll have multiple hearings. And so I want you to know, I have not closed public testimony, and I want the folks in the audience to know, there are multiple challenges that we face, including scheduling. And so today, my goal was to start the testimony, not to in some way say that the only voice on the subject are the experts of the government. I do want and intend to continue hearings, and I would like to say, I didn't plan to do this, but Monday morning I will pick up public testimony from anybody else in this audience or anybody else that would like to come, and I am going to adjourn the meeting now. And I know that that's offensive to some of you. My deepest apologies. I'm doing the best I can. So Monday morning, we will take testimony again. We're adjourned.